The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello! Happy New Year to all you lovely, lovely Slate Money listeners. Thank you for listening to Slate Money. Welcome to 2017. 2017 is going to be the best year of Slate Money ever, because this is going to be a year full of policy wonkery and things actually happening, and we're going to start it off with all manner of policy wonkery, and we haven't even got to the inauguration yet. So trust me, this is going to be the year you want to subscribe to Slate Money and tell all of your friends to subscribe to Slate Money, and basically just orient your entire lives around Slate Money.
Wow.
Because
I don't think that's too hard to sell.
Do you think? That's, yeah, I think you may have gone a little far.
I think we jumped the shark here.
Yeah,
it was worth a try.
Although the cult of Slate Money is sort of, there is something.
If anyone wants to start a religion, you know, centered on Slate Money, just
Felix
feel free.
Would love nothing more than a cult of personality, a religion surrounding.
You know, I'm like the Duke of Edinburgh. You know, he was worshipped as a god in some South Pacific island.
Hashtag life goals.
Many ways I'm like that random Greek racist. But anyway, we will not talk about the Duke of Edinburgh, because we want to talk about Donald Trump instead. We are going to talk a little bit about Donald Trump, and specifically not so much his assets as his liabilities. And those are going to cause very interesting implications for conflicts of interest and the like. We are going to talk about public companies. Where did they go? They've kind of disappeared. And, basically, I should introduce us, shouldn't I?
Oh, yeah.
For those of us who don't know who we are, I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion. Kathy, who are you?
I'm Kathy O'Neill. I blog. I'm a data scientist. I wrote a book called Weapons of Mass Destruction.
Go read the book, people. And Jordan, who are you?
I'm the Moneybox columnist for Slate.
Like, basically, we couldn't afford a third regular panelist, so we just drag Jordan in from his desk every week.
We love Jordan.
Jordan's the best. Jordan's very cool.
I'm the cheap help.
Jordan has been
free labor
talking about mortgage interest deductions on Twitter, and we want to know. You should email us on slatemoney@slate.com. That's slatemoney@slate.com. Should we have a segment on the mortgage interest deduction, or should we have an entire episode on the mortgage interest deduction?
It's one of the other guys.
Is that a great idea or the best idea?
We're either going big or bigger. It's one or the other.
Kathy.
Yeah.
Let's talk about pink collar jobs, because this is a really kind of fascinating subject.
Yeah, it is. And I'm going to start with like a little theme that our good friend Shane Farrow started as a conversation on Twitter.
Oh, and by the way, hi, Mom. Terry Farrow is the best listener.
Oh, I know. I know. She's the best. I'm going to have a beer with her tonight. Here's my question for you. What do Siri and Alexa and all other chatbots have in common?
I don't know, Kathy.
Artificial intelligence and voice recognition?
yes, they're all chatbots. Yes, but that wasn't what I was going for. The answer is they're all female, or essentially female. I mean, some of them you can adjust their voice to be male.
So when Siri first came out, there was a version of Siri who understood American accents and a version of Siri who understood British accents. And so obviously I had the British Siri, who everyone called Boy Siri, because the British Siri had a man's voice rather than a woman's voice.
I didn't even
but
know
then
that.
I don't know what happened, and now Siri is just a girl again.
Okay, well, I mean, and by the way, there was this really interesting New Yorker piece that that Shane actually brought me to over Twitter that explained that if you ask Siri, "Who are you?" the answer is, "Who I am isn't important." If you ask Alexa, if you tell Alexa that she's dumb, she'll say, "Sorry, thanks for telling me." If you tell Alexa that you're smart, she'll say, "You really think so? Thank you." And the reason I'm giving
Kathy,
these...
you're smart.
The reason I'm giving these examples is because it's a part of a general theme where in our society, women are expected to be helpful, to be caregiving, and to be relatively passive. And that expectation set is what we want to talk about with this respect to jobs. Now,
wait, hang on a sec.
Yeah.
Before we disappear to jobs, I just want to stay on Siri and Alexa for 1 minute. I can see how if you want a smart assistant to be passive and helpful.
Yeah.
Then because passive and helpful are sort of gendered, you kind of naturally gravitate to making that assistant female. The question I have is if we wind up in a world where a bunch of women have passive and helpful female assistants, does that basically create a world where passive and helpful becomes a robot thing? Or does that make passive and helpful even more gendered?
I mean, good question. I think the answer is it makes it even more gendered. And I mean, the way I look at it, of course, I have a very specific perspective because I am a woman who is actually a bitch. And so when people expect me to be passive and helpful, I'm like, you can fuck yourself. And like this actually, I don't know.
Which is if Alexa were a Kathy girl rather than a sort of passive and helpful girl, it'd be, Alexa, can you remind me to wake up at 9 o'clock in the morning? Oh, go fuck yourself.
Exactly. Not a very successful chatbot, I would say. My chatbot like existence would be relatively short, I'm pretty sure. I mean, I'm someone who like I actually left academia in part because I was expected to be passive and helpful in the math department. And the men in the same position that I was in were not expected to be like that. So it's very raw to me. But I want to bring that, I want to talk about the Bureau of Labor Statistics now, because what's going on right now is that we've lost tons of jobs. We've lost 5 million manufacturing jobs since 2000, tons of male-dominated jobs. And what we're seeing in the next 10 years, which is what the Bureau of Labor Statistics came out with, sort of projections for jobs in the next 10 years, we're seeing tons, millions, in fact, of jobs in women-dominated fields.
So this is what we used to call the man session.
Sort of. Yeah, sort of. I mean, this is a longer term trend even than the man session. It's a further shift into service industries. And so it's whereas, you know, hard manufacturing industries used to be male dominated, now we're shifting to health and caretaking, things along those lines where they've traditionally been female. So the man session was something specific to what happened during the Great Recession. This is a 30-year trend that is going further and further and further.
Yeah, that's right. And it's a trend that affects mostly people that don't have college educations, I should add. Like the manufacturing jobs were specific to men that didn't have college educations but finished high school and said, I can get a good job and support my family. And those jobs are disappearing, as we all know. And the point that the New York Times Upshot article this week talked about was that these very men who have lost their jobs are not willing to retrain and take the jobs that are actually growing.
Because there are two reasons for this. One is that the service industry jobs pay less than they used to be earning in manufacturing industry, even though like the first derivative is good. You know, the amount of pay that is going up rather than down, the absolute level is bad. They're like, I'm not going to take a job which pays $12 an hour. I used to work, I earn $20 now. And so there's a kind of pride thing there. And then the second reason is just that the jobs are gendered. And they're like, I don't want to be a nurse because that's a woman's job.
That's right. And it's not, you know, I just want to reiterate what you just said. Like, these jobs do pay less. They're typically like $11 an hour instead of $18, which is what they remember getting. But right now they get $0 an hour. Moreover, these jobs, I mean, because they're growing, have much more job stability. And often they come with benefits, not as good benefits as they are used to. But it's a kind of like positioning of expectations that a lot of men have trouble dealing with.
$0 an hour might be a little bit of an exaggeration. That's one thing conservatives will bring up is that some of these men have gone on disability, for instance, things along those lines. They do find ways to kind of patch together a living and maintain living standards. If they're younger, they go back with their parents, things like that, even if they're not working. So they're, you know, going back to work in a lower paying job isn't necessarily going to increase their welfare as far as they're concerned. Let's put it that way. And, there is this kind of frustration because you say, okay, we have these growing industries and men won't take these jobs. And on top of it, you see what they call prime age male labor force participation declining. Guys who are in their prime years are just less likely to work than they used to be. So how do we fix it? You know, how do we get these guys to train to be nurses or whatever? And to that, I kind of say is like, have you ever met a construction worker? Have you ever like spent time with like a former factory guy? Is like, when they say I don't you know, I don't fit this line of work. I'm not suited for it. They're not bullshitting. Like, I mean, see,
okay, and
it's
that's
really,
where I would.
They're really not. Like, I mean, you talk to, you spend time with them. Like, this is, you know, some people don't have the temperament and the patience to go and work in a hospital all day. It takes a certain kind of person.
Okay, but there are a lot of jobs in hospitals, nursing jobs particularly, which require a lot of, like, lifting human beings, and actually it's very helpful to be a, you know, big, burly, strong man. There are two things which give me hope here. One is that as the number of manufacturing jobs declines from what has been a relatively low base for quite some time, the number of men who have manufacturing industry jobs or who had manufacturing industry jobs is also going to decline. And so it's going to be less and less of an issue that I used to have this manufacturing job and now I don't want to become a nurse because I never had the manufacturing job in the first place. And then the second thing is that when you look at what happens to men when they enter these professions, they generally get paid more and they get promoted faster than their female counterparts. And the more men that enter a certain profession, whether it's, I don't know, like dental technicians or something like that, the less gendered that profession becomes. And so inevitably, I think, you know, as manufacturing dries up, men who have never been in the manufacturing industry are going to wind up taking these jobs, which are steady jobs with good benefits and all the rest of it. And as they do so, those jobs are going to be less and less gendered.
I want to jump in and mention that, in fact, there is already a racial divide in this. That, like, black men are much more likely to take these jobs already, including home health aides, personal care aides, and registered nurses, which are the three job categories that are supposed to grow the most. But I also want to mention that I don't think this is necessarily a gender thing, right? I personally would have a lot of adjustment to make myself to take one of these jobs, right? It's like, I think we have to ask ourselves, you know, like, how much of it is like, oh, those people should just find a way to fit themselves into this new job category, and how much it is like,
but that's because,
really,
that's because
a lot to ask of anyone.
You're not a caring person, Kathy.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I am not a caring person. I don't feel like I am the right person for that job. I feel like I want, like, 6 hours a day of being by myself. Yeah.
So also about your optimism, Felix, I think there's something to that. However, this trend where we're seeing men staying out of the workforce, we see it with younger guys too, people who grew up after who have been growing up after the manufacturing bust. And so I think there is this strong gendered component about what kind of job is appropriate for a man, even if those jobs never existed for these people. Even if these people never had an opportunity to get a manufacturing job, that is still their idea, or you know, construction is their ideal, and they can't find that for whatever reason now because the housing market in their community went bust. So, you know, it's I don't think time is necessarily alone going to heal these wounds in the economy. We need to actually find a way to reorient the way men think about their careers.
I agree. I don't think machismo as a general fad has decreased. And this is very related to that question of like, who am I as a person and how do I fit myself into this? I would just want to say one last thing about this, which is like, I think we've trained ourselves, you know, in the last 40 years to think about jobs as sort of commodified objects that we can just flip from one job to the next. And the only question we're going to ask ourselves is like, how much does it pay? Do I have to accept a pay cut or a pay raise? Historically, people were this, you know, in a family business, they had the same kind of job for decades. You know, they were farmers for decades and decades, for generations upon generations. Like, the expectation that economists have that people can just switch up very quickly is just not true. I just think it's a mistake to believe that.
Yeah, and it's weird because we don't have that expectation necessarily for higher, like, for, you know, upper middle class professionals. We have this idea that your job is your identity, but somehow we lose track of that when we talk about people in working class jobs. You think, oh, well, it's just a paycheck. But actually, no, their identity is very, very much, maybe even more so to some extent, tied up with the job they do.
Yeah, it's not easy for a doctor to become a lawyer or vice versa.
Well, those are both white collar professions. I don't share your optimism. I think that I agree with Jordan. I don't see how this is going to play out well.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Donald Trump has a lot of money.
Yes, I've heard
and
that.
And like...
That's what he says.
Many rich people, he has a lot of debt. And there's been a fascinating article in the Wall Street Journal this week about the debt rather than... People have been concentrating on the assets. And they're like, you own this hotel, you own this building, you own this property in this foreign country, and how is that going to be a conflict of interest, you know, given your role as president? So the Wall Street Journal did the flip side of that. And they said, well, what about the debts?
And that's more important, really.
And in many ways, it's more important. You're absolutely right. And so they started looking around. And of course, because we live in a, you know, financialized world, Donald Trump's debts have been securitized. And so they're everywhere. There are hundreds of millions of dollars of these things. And they're owned, I mean, just to give one example, Vanguard alone owns more than $200 million worth of Donald Trump's debts. And this is really fascinating to me because it's a really interesting potential conflict because Donald Trump has a long history of either defaulting on or renegotiating or his debts. And in fact, every rich, you know, billionaire or corporation who has debts is constantly doing this thing called liability management, which is a perfectly legitimate and normal thing for all people with debts to do if they're big debts, you know, if they're not credit card debts or even credit card debts for that matter. When you move your credit card debt from a high interest card to a low interest card, that's liability management. And it's perfectly legal and you're not defaulting. So the question is, when Donald Trump has hundreds of millions of dollars of debts and he's trying to manage those debts and at the extreme case, possibly even default on those debts, how do the creditors respond? Because they're not just trying to maximize their return on how much they paid for the debt. They're also saying, well, this is a way that we're dealing with the president of the United States. And the different ways that that might happen, different ways that that might play out, I think are really fascinating to me.
Well, can we just back up a little bit? I mean, because I feel like Trump, we have some history of this before he was president, obviously. But like he kind of almost defaulted on debt before.
He defaulted on debt four times
before. Okay, well, but there were, I think, isn't it Deutsche Bank that responded by just extending his debt? Or was that Wells Fargo?
Deutsche Bank was one of the few large banks that would extend his company's large lines of credit. These securitized debts, which people didn't know about until this Wall Street Journal investigation, essentially, are mostly to companies and entities he has like a 30% stake in. And that's why we didn't know about them, because he didn't actually put them on his federal elections.
Right. But let's go back to Kathy's point.
Yeah.
If I'm a creditor and, you know, if you're Donald Trump and I'm a lender to you and I've lent you a bunch of money, you know, I basically have two choices when you run into money. Either I can extend the line of credit so that you don't officially default and then I hope that eventually you'll repay me, the kind of extend and pretend or delay and pray or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you say, okay, buster, enough, I'm foreclosing, which is also a completely legitimate move, but then you wind up owning a casino in Atlantic City, and who the hell wants to own a casino in Atlantic City, and you wind up losing money. So a lot of banks, it can be an entirely rational, not, it's not just because he's Donald Trump.
No.
But a lot of these banks also have made this calculation, which is one of the reasons why they made the loan in the first place. The buildings with the Trump name on them are somehow that much more valuable just for having the Trump name on them. And so they want to keep the Trump name on them. They want to keep Trump involved in some way. And those kind of calculations become much, much more top of mind when Trump is the president. And what has fascinated me in particular is this idea that because loans and bonds are tradable, that what you wind up with is actually you don't have Trump simply negotiating with his creditors. What you have is an auction among every single person and sovereign wealth fund and country and businessman and corrupt drug lord and you name it in the world can start competing to buy this distressed debt. If the debt looks like it's going to be renegotiated in any way, even if it's not distressed, even if he just wants to renegotiate the interest rates or something like that, everyone is going to be wanting to own that debt so that they can be the people sitting across the table from him and doing him a favor and saying, hey, guess what? We'll give you a concessional rate because you're the president.
Oh my God. So you're saying that like they're going to pay more for that debt because they think they'll have something on him.
Because they get to negotiate with the president of the United States and they get to do him a favor, and being having him like you because you did a favor for him is something which everyone's going
to
want.
Or at least you get to negotiate with, I guess, Donald Trump Jr. and go through that intermediary.
Or,
I guess my question is, the fact that this debt has been securitized, this what you're bringing up now is one huge issue with that, the fact that it's tradable, and so some drug lord in Mexico can try to buy the debt. Are there other ways that changes the dynamic of him owing money all around town as opposed to just having bonds, you know, or having debt to a regular bank? Is there anything other, any other
concerns? I think it makes it more easy for to do what Felix is saying, which is sell it.
Okay.
Right, because it's securitized, which means it's like just a piece of a contract that's easy to trade.
Yeah, trading loans is difficult. Yeah. Trading bonds is easy.
So having the president of the United States with a ton of outstanding debt floating around the
bonded debt
floating around the markets that anybody in the world can get a piece of, and thus get a piece of Trump and get access to his company, is the situation we now find ourselves in. And we didn't know about it because of federal election rules not requiring him to reveal it on his original disclosures because of the way he owns these entities.
One way of looking at this is to say that one of the conflicts which we didn't have with Donald Trump was that he didn't own any public corporations. There was no one saying, yeah, I can buy shares in Donald Trump Inc. And then if he becomes elected, the shares will go up and I can be a major shareholder. And if I'm a major shareholder, that gives me influence over Donald Trump. And that, if it had been the case, would have been a major conflict, which would have been really difficult to disentangle. And we'd have probably forced him to sell all of his shares or something like that. But what we do have is securities in Donald Trump Inc. They might not be equity securities, they might be debt securities, but they're still securities and they still have a claim on his assets. And so really it's the same thing.
Yeah, I think Trump actually backed some of these also personally too. That's what makes some of it scary. Some of this debt,
so some of them are guaranteed by Donald Trump personally.
Which is, that makes this even scarier because it's not even like he's got limited liability of some kind or something like that.
Unbelievable.
So, welcome to Conflict of Interest this Stan. It's going to be fascinating to see this one play out.
Just one question. Like, do other presidents have this kind of, I mean, obviously they don't have the extent of debt. We would have heard about that. But like, how does this compare to like other presidents?
So, I think you have to go back to what the Kennedys and the Roosevelts to find any kind of presidents who are remotely this rich. And I don't think that the Kennedys and the Roosevelts had debts like that. They're certainly not traded debt.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not. They weren't securitizing the Roosevelt family fortune at that point. So
he's found a new way.
I think this is unprecedented.
Unprecedented. That can be cut. I wait.
Keep that.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Jordan.
Yeah.
We have one more segment.
We do have one more
so
segment.
So come up with something. We don't just throw this show together, you know.
Let me put in my password.
Jordan has literally opened up his laptop and is typing away desperately to try and come up with a segment here.
I've got a Word doc with a bunch of numbers in it. It's going to be exciting, I promise. Okay, so public companies. They're kind of dying. They're disappearing. They're becoming dinosaurs, right? There was a paper that came out not too long ago that was just like asking, like, what the hell is happening to the public corporation America, which is like supposed to be like the gold standard of American business for so long, right? Like the company you buy stock in. And so here are a few numbers I just want to share. In 1975, there were 4,819 public corporations in America. By 1997, they had reached a peak of 7,507. And now they fall into about 3,766, which
about.
Is about, yes, about
roughly 3,766,
about
four significant figures, roughly.
And so we've seen this just die off since the late 90s, where we've just seen this massive consolidation of industry for just this variety of factors.
And there's three or four different ways that this happens, yeah. Just to be clear. One is that you have mergers, that yeah. two public companies merge mm-hmm. and they become one. One is that you have companies going private, so you have private equity coming in and buying a public company. One is that the company just goes bust. There's a bunch of ways this can happen. These things have always happened, by the way. These mergers and takeovers and bankruptcies have always happened, but we have a birth-death model, right? And those are the ways that companies die. And then the way that public companies are born, there's really only one way for a public company to be born, and that's this thing called the IPO.
Yeah. And right now, deaths are outnumbering births, is the bottom
line. IPOs have been very, very low yeah. for years now. In fact, for basically a decade.
Yeah. And so, you know,
two decades.
What's more than that, it's not just about the sheer number of companies, but it's about what's happened to them, what they actually do. And what this paper looked at is like, well, these companies have kind of gotten, they're fatter and lazier, and they basically don't invest as much as they used to in either R&D or in, when you combine R&D and capital investments, things like machinery, and they just return a lot of money to shareholders. And so there's this quote at the end of it that's been getting a lot of play. It says, as a whole, public firms appear to lack ambition, proper incentives, or opportunities. They are returning capital to investors and hoarding cash rather than raising funds to invest more. And so there's this question, is just like, have we come to a phase where, you know, taking companies public, just not really useful anymore. It's just not a great management model.
I think the reason why companies went public was that that's where the money was. There were hundreds of millions of Americans, a large proportion of whom had the ability and inclination to invest in the stock market. And if you wanted to tap that enormous pool of capital, the way you did that was by going public and getting money from, you know, Mrs. Jones in Nebraska, who had a bit of money in her stock market account. And as inequality has increased, Mrs. Jones in Nebraska no longer has so much money in her stock market account that you're particularly interested in Mrs. Jones. And the people who do have money are, you know, sovereign wealth funds and billionaires who have lots of ability to invest in private companies. And so private companies can raise billions and billions of dollars. They don't need to go public anymore. And there are lots of advantages to managers and to CEOs in particular of not going public. Going public sucks. It gives you a whole bunch of public scrutiny, which no one likes. And so they have the choice. And given the choice, they make the rational choice to stay private.
Well, let me say something.
Yeah.
So I'm going to just reframe it because I'm not disagreeing with anything you guys have said, but it sounds like companies used to be forced by necessity to crowdsource. And now they just find that one billionaire or a few billionaires who just can give them the money they want.
Called Kleiner Perkins or whatever. Exactly.
Right. And so they know what they only have to deal with three people instead of, you know, 30,000 people.
And what's more, those three people can be extremely helpful to them in growing their business in the way that anonymous shareholders can't be.
So the other aspect, which I think we should bring in, is this shareholder value, revolution, which is kind of the bad news about going IPO that probably people are avoiding, right? Which is that once you do go IPO and you have all these shareholders, you're expected to care about them and them only. And you're not expected to care about your business very much anymore, just about pleasing those guys. And that is a lot of problems.
And so the reason why people bought shares historically, there was really only one reason to buy shares, and that's because you wanted the share price to go up. And if the share price went up, you were happy. And if the share price didn't go up, you were unhappy. And because the shareholders are the residual claimants on the cash flow of the company, and people kind of equated that with ownership, and because the shareholders get to elect the board of directors, everyone was like, well, it's the job of a company to maximize returns to shareholders. And Justin Fox had a very interesting column about this, where he was like, well, there's a revolution here. And the name of the revolution is kind of Trumpism in some ways. So Donald Trump is looking at companies. He owns a private company, which has never had the same kind of we need to maximize the share price imperative. And he looks at companies in a way that they have a bunch of different roles. And one of the main roles they have is to make America great again and to make things in America and to create jobs and to pay well and all of these other things, which are kind of, you know, old-fashionedly paternalistic and have no real place in this kind of shareholder value world of the 1980s and 90s.
I do want to disagree with one thing that Felix just said. It's not that shareholders spontaneously came up with this idea that of shareholder value. I think it was orchestrated by a few people. I don't know the exact history of it, but I've read about it.
Milton Friedman was in there somewhere.
Some of the guys like
so
Jensen.
It was a real thing that happened, and it happened around the time of the peak of the number of companies.
In the 70s and 80s, you got a lot, basically business professors were some of the people, and like finance professors were the guys who kind of came up with this idea. And, you know, the idea behind the concept behind shareholder value was sort of sound at the time, which was that if you, you know, paid more attention to the need to return cash to your shareholders, you would be driven more to make a profit and to watch the bottom line and be a hungry, you know, hungry, agile company, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I think that worked for a long time, but now you get this combination of this idea of shareholder value with concentration in industry, when in some ways a lot of these companies are just facing less competition. And so they can just kind of sit on what we call rents. They can just kind of take in all this money because they have, they don't necessarily have a monopoly, but they have close to it. And so the money just flows in. And so, you know, as far as they see it, the easy thing to do rather than be an agile, hungry company trying to innovate or whatever and invest is just give money to your shareholders because that's your job anyway. So you sit there, you wait for the cash to roll in, and then you do a stock buyback. And so it's kind of come full circle where shareholder value has brought us back to where the problems of corporate America that existed 30, 40 years ago that it was supposed to combat.
So the big question here is, like, is this bad for us? Whereby us, I mean the shareholding public, or what used to be the shareholding public. Is there a case to be made that all of the really interesting and valuable investments out there these days are in private companies rather than public companies, that those investments are only accessible to the ultra wealthy, and that the broad democracy of shareholders that was the dream of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher has gone by the wayside because normal people are left with just a kind of rump group of public companies which are really boring and don't have the sort of golden future that the private companies do?
I think the answer is yes to that very long question. And I feel like most people in this country invest in the market through their retirement funds. And those retirement funds are investing in these boring companies that are don't have much of a vision and are doing their best to just give back money to shareholders, which sounds good in the short term. But in the long term, that's not a very innovative use.
My answer to the question, by the way, is no.
Okay.
And I've changed my mind on this one. At one point, I thought the answer was yes. And I actually wrote a New York Times op-ed saying that the answer was yes. And now I've changed my mind. And I was wrong when I wrote that New York Times op-ed. I think the answer is no, that the private companies are a place for, you know, billionaire, whimsy people to burn their stupid cash, which they don't need, and that there is ample opportunity in the stock market to really invest in the global economy as a whole, that the public markets, for all that there are fewer companies, are bigger than they've ever been, and especially in this globalized world, if you're buying sort of global indices, there are companies all over the world which you can invest in and which really have a lot of growth ahead of them and are perfectly innovative and successful. And I don't think that we should have this kind of FOMO. I don't think that we should feel to ourselves that we're missing out on something great just because we can't invest in Uber.
I would say that I am not a proponent of pushing everyone to invest. But I do say that if this goes to an extreme where all the exciting companies are owned by VCs, and all the boring companies are publicly traded, that's a problem.
Yeah, I would say I'm less concerned about this as a problem for shareholders, given that, you know, in the end, you can just invest in the S&P 500 and these big market cap companies are returning a ton of cash to you, so you're not doing so bad. Or mom and pop shareholders. I think the bigger issue a lot of people are concerned about, at least in econ, is the macro effects of this, right? What does it do to our economy long term if the, you know, what used to be the major corporate form in this country, or the most important corporate form in this country, isn't performing anymore. One thing that's interesting also, and it's probably my last point, is that Hillary Clinton tried to kind of bring this up during her campaign. This was actually an early theme of hers, is corporate short-termism and combating it and looking for ways to combat it. And it was really ill-formed and her ideas weren't very good. It was like toying with the capital gains rate in ways that might make them invest more long-term. But it seems as if she was at least on to a real issue. There was like a real...
She saying that public companies are good or public companies are bad?
She was saying that they needed to think less in terms of short-termism. They needed to think more in terms of... They needed to do more in terms of investment in R&D. And that does seem to be one of the results of you know, this laziness among public companies, is that we are getting less investment.
If we want to encourage that, we would have to break up these monopolies.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Or these near monopolies. It's not something you just tell a company to start wanting to do.
Exactly. I'm not saying Clinton's... I think it was interesting that there was some this actually almost became a political issue and then kind of fell by the wayside.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
All right, let's have a numbers round here because God knows, you know, Jordan will turn everything political if you give him half a chance.
Yeah, well, that's my job.
Everything is political.
That's my day job, man.
Okay, so I have a number. It's a sad number. 33,000. That's how many people have died in the United States from the opioid epidemic just last year. 2015. I want you to compare that. That's more than the number of people that were killed by guns, almost as many as the number of people that were killed in car accidents. And in the worst year of HIV deaths, we had 50,000. The worst year of HIV deaths, we now have 33,000 deaths in opioids, and there is no end in sight. It's a really huge thing. I want to recommend, because this is what I did over Christmas because I like to be depressed, I read this amazing book by Sam Kanonis called Dreamland that really goes in a wonderful investigative journalism piece about the prescription drugs industry contribution to the current opioid epidemic, as well as the Mexican heroin industry.
Jordan.
Okay, I'm going to go political one more time. My number is 2. I'm going to break form a little bit and give a story before I get to the number, which is in August of 2007, the chief economist of Bear Stearns wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal about how you shouldn't worry about the credit market. You shouldn't worry about the credit crisis.
Oh, good.
Is the headline. Mm-hmm. This is August of 2007. And everything was fine. He said that the Bush boom was probably going to continue. And that,
but he still called it the crisis?
Yeah, I think he's like, don't worry about the credit crisis. He said the problems in the credit, or at least the headline did, but the problems in the market are just a correction and things are going to be swell. And in fact, if home prices fall, don't worry. That's also just a correction. We have long-term prosperity ahead. 2 days later, BNP Paribas had to then freeze 3 of its hedge funds, thus starting the true beginning of the credit crunch that then metastasized into the financial crisis of 2008 eventually. David Malpass eventually became an advisor to Donald Trump's campaign, is now being assigned to the Treasury Department as Undersecretary of International Affairs. One of his jobs is going to be spotting problems in international finance and making sure that the world doesn't burn. So we have that eagle-eyed scout now at Treasury.
So, yeah, it's very easy to make fun of David Malpass. Honestly, It's a fascinating job, and I've written at some length about
Tim Geithner's old job.
It's Larry Summers' old job. It's Leo Brainerd's old job. Yeah. Virtually everyone, Tim Adams, virtually everyone, Randy Quarles, all these people who you may not have heard of, but are super smart sort of technocrats have had this job. It's a fascinating job, which is normally done by sort of serious people who take it seriously. John Taylor. Mm-hmm. And I have a little bit of hope that David Malpass is going to fit into that tradition of like technocratically trying to keep the wheels of international finance oiled. You know, it's not a job where you need to stare into a crystal ball and guess what the future is. That's really not what the job is. It's a job of being able to sort of schmooze other finance secretaries and sort of understand how international finance is working and not working and trying to make it work a bit better. I think he can do it. I don't think he's like, you know, a great economist, but I think he can do this job.
I think part of it is that when the world's on fire, you're in that job expected to be part of the fire department. You're supposed to show up with a bucket of water.
That is true. Yeah.
And, you know, if you look, it's not just that he blew the call on the financial crisis. It's that in the years afterwards, he was sitting around talking about how we needed higher interest rates and we needed to have a stronger dollar in the U.S. and that was what was going to fix everything. And so the idea of him being the one we're expecting to come and help save the day if for some reason China explodes or Europe explodes is a little frightening.
He's not a wise man.
He's not someone whose judgment I want to rely on if the world, again, is kind of up Schitt's Creek and we need a paddle.
My number is 1.00928. Why not?
I wonder what that is.
This actually comes from Twitter. This comes from a lovely chap called Andrew Lovseth on Twitter, who said, can we talk about this? So, hi, Andrew. We're going to talk about this. This is the most recent number I could find for 3-month dollar LIBOR. And, of course, all listeners to Slate Money know what 3-month dollar LIBOR is. It is the first time that 3-month dollar LIBOR has been higher than 1%. It's a percentage, by the way, 1.00928%. It's the first time we have been above 1% since May 2009. It's been a very long time. We have interest rates now, people. it's kind of unprecedented. We've got liftoff. We actually have single-digit interest rates. Congratulations. 3-month dollar LIBOR is kind of the single most important interest rate out there in commerce. It's the rate that most floating rate debt is linked to, and it's and of course most debt is floating rate debt, so or swapped into floating rate. So it's a hugely important benchmark, and the fact that it's over 1% means that, you know, it's good for investors, it's bad for borrowers, but it also just means a little bit of normalization, I think. But anyway, that is it. That is it for us this week. Thank you for listening to Slate Money. Next week, we may or may not talk about mortgage interest deductions because, you know, is there ever too much talk about mortgage interest deductions? Subscribe to us. Write to us. The email address is slatemoney@slate.com. Thank Zach Dinerstein, the producer and the executive producers to Steve Lickteig and Andy Bowers. Find all the Panoply podcasts at itunes.com/panoply, and we will talk to you next week on Slate Money. I'm using elbow grease to bring in the beans, working at a blue collar job. The money's not enough to let you live, it's barely enough to scrape by, and not the full.